So, Matt, I learned today that there is one national monument of the United States that's always in a hurry. And it makes sense now that I think about it. It's Mount Rushmore.
Yeah, I saw it. I saw it. I knew it was coming. Food's good.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the graveyard. Thank you for joining us tonight. My name is Adam.
And my name's Matt.
Now, pull up a tombstone or settle into your casket and get comfortable, because this is Graveyard Tales.
All right, everybody, here we are again. Matt, how you doing tonight, brother?
Man, I am cold.
Yeah. I believe it.
I mean, have you seen this crap? I mean, Florida is getting snow.
Mm-hmm.
And we're just getting the zero temperatures. It is brutal.
Yeah. It's been cold here in the mornings, but like now it's, I don't know, high 40s, low 50s. So it's not bad. Can't believe a Texan is saying high 40s is not bad, but. It's not. Yeah. I lived up there in Tennessee. It's not bad.
We're not used to this. Even though I'm looking at the weather right at the moment, and it says 56. It does not believe that I'm where I'm at. Oh no, it thinks I'm in Hazlitt, Texas.
Oh yeah, see. See?
Why would it think that I'm in Texas? I'm talking to you too much is what it is.
That's what it is. It's like you just need to be in Texas. That's what they're saying. So, Matt, before we get into everything, I just have to say this to everybody. This is episode 300.
That's right.
I cannot believe we've made it to episode 300. It's taken years.
Yes.
But, you know, Matt and I wanted to say to all of y'all that we would not have gotten to this point or been able to keep this up if it wasn't for your support of Matt and I and Graveyard Tales. And, you know, it's very much appreciated to do episode 300 and know we've got more in the bag. We're going to do more. This is not the end, of course, but, you know, 300 is a big milestone for us.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said, we couldn't have done it without the support that y'all have shown us over the years.
100%, because, you know, when we started this, we are still 100% independent podcasters.
Yep.
And, you know, independent podcasters, you know, typically they don't make it to 300 episodes because of a multitude of reasons. I mean, I've listened to some incredible shows that just kind of fade away because you know what, life happens. But Adam and I have been able to continue, and it is entirely due to our listeners.
Yep.
And encouraging us and, you know, complimenting us and supporting us that has got us to 300 episodes. So thank you guys from the bottom of our hearts. We would have never gotten here without y'all.
No. And Matt and I, when we started this venture, we didn't think long term, like this long term, really. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't know if I'm speaking out of turn for Matt, but you know, we were thinking a year or two down the road and that's about it. It's been since 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this is not a multiple episode a week podcast. You know, this is a, one episode, like three episodes, four episodes a month. So it takes a while to get to 300.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were talking about it the other day and we cannot believe that we've made it to 300 and still, you know, we have the passion for it that we always have. And that's because y'all encourage us. You encourage this tomfoolery. So either thank you or it's your fault. One of the two. I don't know.
That's right. That's right. And it's been a unbelievable ride, and we look forward to 300 more.
Absolutely. So now that we've gotten the mushy, heartfelt stuff out of the way, we'll say go check out the Podbelly Network. We're proud to be members of the Podbelly Network and proud to be associated with those shows. You can find a whole list of shows there that are with the Podbelly Network, and I promise you, you're going to find something on there that you enjoy. Also, go over to patreon.com/graveyardtales, sign up to become a patron. We have a huge list of episodes there as well that are all bonus episodes, and we have three different levels, 1, 5, and 10, and for $1 a month, you can get all the bonus episodes. But if you move up and you go to 5 or 10, you can get not only the bonus episodes, but you can get ad-free audio and video versions of the main episode and the video version of the bonus episode. Plus, if you move to 10, then you get our second show, Side Quest, which we earlier this week will have released the 50th episode of that show.
I know that was that one snuck up on us.
I know. We just doing them, and then all of a sudden, holy cow, it's 50. Mm-hmm. But again, that's something else that we couldn't do without the support of our patrons. But if you want to get a whole back catalog of episodes, go over there to patreon.com/graveyardtales and sign up. And $10 a month, I mean, that's 1 to 2 cups of coffee, depending on where you go. Mm-hmm. So just skip 1 or 2 cups of coffee a month going out somewhere, make it at home, and you can get a whole bunch of episodes over there, bonus episodes about a whole litany of things.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you can start buying Graveyard Tales coffee, which is absolutely 100% not in the works.
Right.
Yeah. We have no coffee beans or anything.
No. Nope. You know. I mean, I have beans, but they're by a whole nother company.
That's right.
I wouldn't even know how to roast a bean. I know how to make a good cup of coffee, but that's about it. So, Matt, that's all I've got for the intro and the heartfelt, mushy, gushy stuff. So why don't you tell us? What are we talking about tonight, brother?
Well, since this episode is dropping on Valentine's Day, happy Valentine's Day to all you ladies out there, to all you guys,
yep. All you lovers.
This is one of the weirdest holidays you have to encounter.
It really is. It really is. Ashley and I don't really celebrate Valentine's Day. We're just
nor
like
do we.
It, you know, I get her flowers randomly, you know, every month she'll get some flowers from me or something that, you know, and if I want to get her chocolates, I just go buy chocolate for her.
Right.
You know, I mean, but yeah, it's Valentine's Day. It's a thing.
Yeah. So in recognition of Valentine's Day, we are going to discuss the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Right.
And you may be thinking, well, this is kind of out of the norm for Graveyard Tales. You're going to discuss, you know, a murder. And we are. But as we know, murders, especially one as violent as this, often leave a mark.
Sure.
And there are quite a few stories that the ghosts of these victims might still be hanging around.
Right.
So we're going to go into the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. I know a lot of people, you've heard it. You may not know the whole story, and it's pretty fascinating. But what comes after is very interesting.
Yeah, very much. And the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, that's not the Valentine's Day I had back in high school. That's a whole nother thing. That was just a poor mark in my history, but
yeah.
And that was a bad joke too. So anyway, as we always say, go check our sources down at the bottom of the show notes. You can find where we found all this information. You can keep going because there is some minutia that I'm not going to cover in the history just for time's sake, because it is going to be a little bit longer history and information than normal because, well, it's episode 300 and it's an interesting event that happened. Now, you know, we're going to have to look at what happened in Chicago on Valentine's Day in 1929 before we can get to Matt's part. So, you know, that's just what we're doing. Sorry if you don't like it, but we're looking at the history. during the 1920s, the bootlegging era, as it was known, George Bugs Moran was a career criminal who was in charge of the North Side Gang in Chicago. Now, he was in competition, like direct competition, with Scarface Al Capone. And when I say direct competition, I mean brutally fighting with.
Yeah, McDonald's and Burger King.
Yeah, yeah. It was a McDonald's and Burger King bloodbath. No, I don't know.
If Ronald McDonald and the King,
yep,
you know, just had it out.
If they had Tommy guns and decided to take out their competition on the corner, that would be this Al Capone and George Bugs Moran,
yeah,
competition here.
There you go.
You think the Twitter wars between these fast food joints are brutal? That has nothing on this. Now, Al Capone, Al Scarface Capone, he was in charge of the South Side Gang. And they fought for control of the smuggling operations in Chicago. So they were both, you know, different sides of Chicago, but they were both fighting to control the bootlegging and everything within Chicago. Mm-hmm. Now, throughout the 20s, both of these men survived several attempted murders. And on one occasion, Moran and his associates drove six cars past a hotel in Cicero, Illinois, where Capone and his associates were having lunch. And they apparently showered this building with more than 1,000 bullets. But Capone made it out.
Yeah.
Somehow he made it out alive.
You know, and I know I don't want to interrupt your flow, Adam, but you know, just you say that, and I think what was it like to live just as a regular person in that time in Chicago?
Yeah.
You're just walking down the street, and the next thing you know, a car pulls up, and they're just blasting bullets into this restaurant.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you're having a nice dinner with your family, and unbeknownst to you, Al Capone is sitting four tables over from you. And then Bugs Moran's people decide to try to take him out. You know, are you collateral damage? You know, you're hiding under the table and all this. Now, granted, the Tommy guns and stuff back in the day were not very accurate. They sprayed a lot of bullets, but they were not very accurate. As I've heard many a service member say, I would rather somebody shoot at me fully automatic than one shot because it is so inaccurate. But that's what they're dealing with. So that's why they showered the place with over 1,000 bullets, was just spray and pray and hope they got them.
Yeah. Plus they're shooting through windows and doors.
Right.
Everything else. And, you know, so bullets are going every which way.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes me wonder, they're not hitting their targets necessarily, but there's going to be somebody in the way.
Somebody's going to get hit. Yeah. Yep. Because you hit glass and the trajectory of that bullet changes, and you hit innocent bystander, you know, Grandma Wilkerson over there that was eating dinner, and you're trying to get Al Capone, but you get Grandma instead. It's just wild. So we need to look at Al Capone and Bugs Moran a little bit. So let's look at Al Capone first. Now, this is directly from FBI.gov about Al Capone. Now, he was born in an immigrant family in Brooklyn, New York, and he was born January 1899. Well, Al Capone quit school after the sixth grade, and he became associated with a notorious street gang. And after, you know, hanging around with them for a while, he became an accepted member of the gang. Now, Johnny Torrio was the street gang leader, and among the other members of that gang was Lucky Luciano, who we know later in life gained some pretty big notoriety. So if you go look up, if you don't know who Lucky Luciano is, go look him up. This is a whole rabbit hole that I'm not going down. But if the mob interests you, Lucky Luciano is big in that. Now,
yeah, old mob stories are crazy, dude, but they're great.
I love hearing it because to me, I think about the mob, you know, the Italian mafia in America. And for some reason, you know, growing up and all that, my thought was that it was further back in time. You know, that it was, I don't know why, but that
I'm with you.
Everything happened like early 1900s, but the mafia was around when I was alive.
Yeah.
You know, and that blew my mind that, yeah, they were not as much in power, but they were still doing things when I was alive. And so the mob stories, the mafia, all of that is just fascinating to me. But about 1920, at Torrio's invitation, Capone joined Torrio in Chicago, where he had become an influential lieutenant in the Colosimo mob. Now, the racket spawned by enactment of the Prohibition Amendment, illegal brewing, distilling, and distribution of beer and liquor, they were viewed as, quote, growth industries. So, again, like we said, we've said it, I don't remember what episode, but we said it about, oh, probably when we did the haunted distillery.
Yeah.
You had Prohibition. Well, people are going to want their alcohol anyway. All you did was open the door by making it illegal, open the door for these mobsters to take advantage of that. So they saw them as growth industries and they got big into them. So Torrio, abetted by Al Capone, intended to take full advantage of these opportunities. So the mob also got interest in legitimate businesses, they say, in the cleaning and dyeing field, and they cultivated influence with receptive public officials, labor unions, and employees associations. So they were doing the illegal racketeering and transportation of alcohol and brewing alcohol, but they also got in legal businesses for money laundering situations. Now, Torrio soon succeeded to full leadership of the gang with the violent demise of Big Jim Colosimo, and Capone gained experience and expertise as his strong right arm. Now, in 1925, Capone became boss when Torrio, he was seriously wounded in an assassination attempt. He gave over control of the mob and then retired to Brooklyn. So now Capone is in charge of that mob. So Capone had built this fearsome reputation, they say, in the ruthless gang rivalries of the period. Now, said struggling to acquire and retain racketeering rights to several areas of Chicago is what he got this notoriety for. He was merciless, you know, ready for revenge, had no problem taking people out. So he was feared quite a bit. Now, that reputation grew as rival gangs were eliminated, and the suburb of Cicero became pretty much, they say, a fiefdom of the Capone mob. So through all this, you know, he's just eliminating competition right and left, and so then took full control of the Cicero suburb. Now, through the 1920s, Capone grew his wealth and his gang through the bootlegging of alcohol, gambling, and prostitution. Well, by 1927, Al Capone was extremely wealthy. He was making about $60 million a year, and his net worth was over $100 million.
And think about the time.
Absolutely.
I mean, he could do whatever he wanted.
Mm-hmm. Yep, he really could.
Yeah.
He either could buy whatever he wanted, buy off whoever he wanted, or he was bloodthirsty enough that he'd just kill them if they got in his way. Mm-hmm. And he was notorious for that, for just eliminating competition, not even trying, just killing them. So let's look at George Bugs Moran. And Moran didn't gain as much notoriety as Al Capone. You know, even the casual listener of this show and any true crime show or anything will know Al Capone. Mm-hmm. You know, there's liquors named after him, cigars named after him. But there's not many people that have heard of Bugs Moran. Mm-hmm. Well, apparently, Bugs Moran was notorious for changing the dates of things and his name and other people's names. And it was all in an attempt to obscure who he was, where he was from, and basically all of his history. So it's been very difficult for years to find anything out about George Bugs Moran. But after many years of digging into stuff, there was an author that was able to figure out his actual origins and piece together everything. So that's how we get the information we have now. So a lot of this information actually comes from the Al Capone Museum, since he was a big part in the Al Capone story. Mm-hmm. So his real name was Adelard Leo Cunin. C-U-N-I-N. I bet I'm pronouncing that wrong, so I apologize. But he was born in St. Paul, Minnesota, on August 21st, 1891. He was the firstborn of Jules Cunin and Marie Diana Gobiel. Now, Jules, being a hard-tempered and mean guy, well, he and Adelard did not get along. But his mom was, you know, this loving mother. She loved her child unconditionally, and that feeling remained reciprocal throughout Moran's life. You know, even in his long absences and with his newfound persona of George Bugs Moran, he still loved his mother unconditionally. Now, in 1906, Adelard Leo Cunin, or Bugs Moran, he was now 15 years old, and he was working for the Stern Tailoring Company. At this time, he's still living with his parents at 105 South Wabasha, and George decided he was going to run away, and he ended up in Chicago around 1910. Well, George hung around with these local child criminals, you know, because at the time there was a lot of young kids doing their own gangs that were tangential to the big, you know, the big boy gangs. So he got in with them, and they found themselves operating a horse snatch racket.
A what?
It sounds terrible, doesn't it? This sounds like something I should not be talking about on one of our episodes.
This sounds like a side quest.
Yeah, instead of that is a side quest title right there. But what they would do is they'd steal a horse, and then they would demand ransom from the owner of that horse to get it back. So it was horse napping is what it was.
Yeah.
They called it a horse snatch racket, which sounds disgusting, when they could have called it horse napping.
Which also seems a little weird for the time, because that sounds like we're in the Wild West.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah, that sounds like something that would happen in 1850 mm-hmm. in Texas.
Exactly.
Or Montana. But that's what they did. And then in 1912, George, along with his, you know, new criminal buddies, they ended up getting caught. So his 1912 arrest branded him with his George Moran tag for the rest of his life. It just happened to be the name that he selected at the time, you know, because his whole life he's been trying to change his name, change where he's born, all this stuff. So Moran had used a lot of aliases to conceal his real name, Adelard Koonin. You know, this article says it's probably to spare his family some shame if his name showed up in the papers.
Yeah.
Which, maybe.
But his name was Adelard.
Right. I would just want to change my name from Adelard. George is much better than Adelard.
Right, but, yeah. You know, it's like the guy that says, goes to change his name, and they said, well, what's your name, sir? And he's like, Joe Lipschitz. He's like, man, I'd want to change my name too. What do you want to change it to? Steve Lipschitz.
Yeah. Yeah. Much better. Thank you. You know, I think it's some of wanting to change it from Adelard and some of wanting to spare his mother.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he probably couldn't care less about his dad, but since he loved his mother so much, he's like, with the name Adelard Koonin here, she's going to get associated with me, so let's figure something else out.
Right.
Now, Moran was charged and spent several stints in jail for that initial crime and then other various subsequent crimes such as burglary and larceny. Well, George finally made it back into society associating with a convict that he had met in Joliet. Now, they hung around the north side of Chicago. Well, just like Capone, Moran sported severe scars on his neck from a knife fight during an outdoor speech by an orator. So Moran confronted some heckler who kept interrupting the speaker, and apparently all hell broke loose. Moran almost lost his life, and so he would wear a buttoned-up collar his whole life to conceal a huge gash that was in his neck and chest. So Al Scarface Capone got that name because he was in a knife fight, got a scar on his face. Yeah. So apropos, well, Moran here apparently had something very similar where his neck was cut down and into his chest from a knife fight.
Yep.
He was more self-conscious about it. He could hide it more than Capone could.
Yeah.
So he would always wear high-collared shirts.
Yeah. And old scar neck is not a...
Right.
Not as cool of a nickname.
Yeah, no. And I think by this time, Scarface has already happened. And so he's like, scar neck, maybe I could be dimple. No, that's not as cool. Dimple neck's not cool. So he just went a whole nother way. And the bugs part of the nickname, they say, was probably derived by newspapermen just for color.
Mm-hmm.
You know, color commentary on him. Because it was noted that George could get hot-tempered or flake out, which is probably why the term bugs was applied. So, like, at the time, if you bugged out, you were freaking out and all that. So they called him George Bugs Moran.
Ah, okay. Okay. Because I always, when I hear bugs, I want it to be
Bunny?
Bugsy.
Oh.
Yeah, or Bugs Bunny. Yeah. But I always think of Bugsy Siegel when you hear that bugs, and it's like,
yeah.
Well, that's an odd thing for multiple gangsters to be a bug or Bugsy or something like that. And I don't think they were the only two either.
No, probably not. But I think it was just, it was commentary on his temperament.
Yeah.
Now, George makes it off to prison another time for robbery in 1918, and the judge sentences him to 1 to 14 years.
What kind of sentence is that?
Right, right. So, you know, you
one,
got...
1 to whenever we decide we want to let you go.
Yeah, yeah. You know, tomorrow or 2 decades. Who knows? I mean,
have you learned your lesson yet?
Yeah. So it was during this stint that he attempted to break out, and he befriended Tommy the Terrible Tuffy. So what an all tease.
He's like Big Petey, Little Petey. Jimmy mm-hmm. the Woman.
Tommy the Terrible Tuffy. Now, after that, you know, attempted breakout and befriending Tommy the Terrible, he's later paroled on February 1st, 1923. Now, through his connections, that kind of greased some palms, and they released him. So he became a full member of the Northside Gang, who now welcomed him with open arms. He's done his time. He's, you know, earned some street cred. Now he's full member of the Northside Gang. Well, on November 10th, 1924, George's boss, mentor, and friend, Dean O'Banion, is killed in his flower shop and gang headquarters. So, running a gang out of a flower shop. Good cover, I would say.
Yeah, not bad.
Now, Louis Altieri, who was supposed to be at the shop that morning, was late due to an evening of heavy drinking. So, two of Torrio Capone gangsters, along with New York's infamous Frank Yale, they walk in pretending to be picking up flowers for Mike Merlot's funeral. Well, instead, they shoot and kill O'Banion. Well, Vincent Drucci was to take control of the O'Banion mob, but just before he took charge, he was killed by Detective Dan Healy in 1927. So at that point, Moran then takes the reins of the Northside Gang. So now you've got kind of the backstory of how both of these people came to run the North Side and the South Side gang. So now let's look at what happened on the St. Valentine's Day Massacre. So February 14th, 1929, there was this recent rash of like very bloody gang violence. It's come to be known as the Beer Wars, because of all the bootlegging and everything that they were fighting over. Mm-hmm. Well, it reached a climax on February 14th, 1929. So Bugs Moran was running his bootlegging operation out of a garage at 2122 North Clark Street. On that day, there were 6 of Bugs Moran's men at the garage. And they, you know, most likely, they think they were probably waiting on another shipment of liquor to come in. And the people that were there were Peter Gusenberg, his brother Frank Gusenberg, James Clark, Reinhardt Schwimmer, Adam Heyer, and Albert Weinschenk. Now, all of these men were associated with the Northside Gang in one way or another. There was another man present, John May, and he had some ties to the gang, you know, a little bit too, but not a full-fledged member. Now, 4 other men, 2 of these men dressed like police officers showed up. So the men that were there, they were thinking that the operation had been busted, mm-hmm. which was, you know, it happened for bootleggers. That's yeah. just part of the deal. So these men, the Northsiders, they gave up their weapons to the people that they thought were police officers, and they lined up against the wall because they're like, look, this happens. They're going to bust us. If we don't shoot at them, we can get out pretty soon. You know, we'll be released on bail. Right. We can go back to doing our thing. Mm-hmm. So why fight it?
Yeah.
So they lined up against the wall. But the guys who were disguised as police officers pulled out Thompson submachine guns and other weapons, and they sprayed a hail of bullets all over these Northsiders. So six of the men died on the scene, and the seventh would die hours later. So they killed six of the Northside gang members immediately. And then the other one, he held on for a little while, but didn't make it too long. Well, the imposters, the police imposters, escaped before the real police could show up and see what had happened there. But Bugs Moran had narrowly escaped this hit. When he saw what he thought were the authorities entering the garage, he, according to John J. Binder in the book Al Capone's Beer Wars, snuck out.
Yeah.
As soon as he saw it, yep, he's like, y'all can take the hit, I'm out of here. And that's what they would do. They'd get the boss out. You know, get the boss out, we'll take the hit. You weren't even here. So Bugs slipped out right before the massacre started. Now, while a ton of gangland battles saw two or three gangsters killed at, you know, one time or another, there had not been gang violence with this much of a death toll up to this point. This was a bloody high death toll. Says, quote, it jumps all the way up to seven in very spectacular fashion using machine guns, Binder told Chicago Stories. So, quote, the crime really shocks America, Jonathan Eeg, author of Get Capone, told Chicago Stories. Quote, there are seven people dead in a parking garage, and not only that, the newspaper photos are gruesome. And yeah, if you go look up, you know, I will use one of those photos as the thumbnail in the thumbnail with other pictures.
Yeah.
But I'm not putting the most violent, bloody one in there, but you can go see them if you look them up.
Isn't that crazy how that something like that would never be in a newspaper nowadays? Right.
Now, yeah.
But then they were like, check this out.
Yeah.
You know, well, nowadays you got to go searching on the web, you know, for some obscure site that decided to post this awful picture.
Yeah.
And, you know, back then it was just like, hey, this happened. Yeah.
Everybody walking down the street and see it. Yeah. I mean, it was the news.
Yeah.
It's what happened. And they weren't trying to edit it for you. Yeah. They're just like, look, if you're wanting to read our paper about this, you're going to see it. We had to see it. You got to see it.
Well, and it kind of makes me wonder if it's not a message to say, this is what's going on in your city. You know, this is how bad this really is.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, maybe. At least to some degree.
Yeah, true. At the time of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, President Herbert Hoover had just been elected, and his priority and his administration's priority was fighting crime. Mm-hmm. So Al Capone was on the top of Hoover's list. So immediately, because of who was targeted, Capone was the number one suspect. But Capone had an alibi. Capone wasn't even in the state at the time of the shooting. He was in Miami, Florida. Mm-hmm. Now, some argue that Capone knew the FBI and the IRS were all over him, and so he wouldn't have done something like that while he was being watched. But others say, of course, Capone was behind it. He didn't pull the trigger himself.
Yeah.
But he hired people to do the job, and he made sure that he was out of town, so he had a valid alibi.
Right, yeah. The boss wasn't going to come and do this.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. He's to a point where he doesn't have to do it. He's got people that will do it. So why do you think he would be the gunman? And apparently, he used men outside of his gang so that they wouldn't be recognized by members of the Northside gang. So he, you know, they said, if he's doing this, the ones that think he was behind it said, well, of course he didn't pull the trigger. And of course he didn't use his own gang members because they would know that these weren't cops. These were some of Capone's henchmen. So that's why it wasn't Southside Capone members and why Capone wasn't there. Now, the shooters were never conclusively identified either. Fred Burke, a member of the St. Louis gang, Egan's Rats, which apparently was allied with Capone's gang, he was widely suspected of being one of the killers. And one of the most compelling pieces of evidence for this was a confession from a man named Byron Bolton. So Bolton served as one of the lookouts for the massacre and told the FBI some years later the, you know, some of the details of this crime. Byron's confession, which the FBI, you know, never acted on, implicated the gangsters Burke, Fred Getz, Gus Winkler, and Raymond Nugent, and Bob Carey were all the killers. But, you know, they didn't act on it, so things kind of, you know, went, time moved on.
It's one of those things where you've got a gangster ratting out other gangsters. You're just kind of thinking, what is this guy's trying to gain something out of this information.
Sure.
How can we even trust it?
Sure. Yeah.
You know, that's so true. So they're not going to immediately cause this big stir by going outside of Chicago to St. Louis to start tracking down these other guys.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Well, the site of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre in Chicago is now a parking lot for a nursing home. And the garage that the massacre took place in, they say, was demolished about 1967.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all of that, you know, a major mass murder, you know, occurs at this spot.
Mm-hmm.
And as I said at the beginning of the show, that's going to leave a stain. Physical and metaphysical. Okay. Yep. because it did. This was such a unique crime, and it was so violent and so brutal, that there was no way that it wasn't going to leave its mark on the energy that surrounds that area where the garage once stood.
Sure.
Now, 20 years after the murder in 1949, the front half of the garage was converted into a business. It was an antique furniture shop.
Hmm.
Now, the couple that started this business claimed that they had no idea what had happened here because they were new to the area. Which, you know, it was 20 years ago. I would imagine that a lot of the people that really remembered the event either had passed on or wanted to forget it.
Right.
Okay. Right. So
it wasn't in their conversations on a daily basis.
Right. Right. And you know, what are you going to do? You're going to walk into some little couple's antique furniture store and go, you know, 20 years ago. You know,
seven people died right here.
Some stuff happened in this place.
Yeah.
You don't do that. And I would imagine that talking about it was probably frowned upon anyway. So these people did not know.
Yeah.
But later, the couple that owned the furniture shop would say that there were some things that happened there that may have led them to think that the building was haunted.
Hmm.
Now, again, not at the time, but looking back on it, they thought, yeah, there was some odd things that happened. Now, the business was not a huge success, mainly because tourists would come and look around. So the people in the area may not have wanted to talk about it, but people that were outside of Chicago.
Yeah.
Would be interested in going and visiting the site of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Early true crime buffs.
It's exactly right. Dark tourists are, you know, in the 1950s and 60s. I mean, people were already kind of enamored with this.
Right.
But the business did finally close in 67. And as Adam said, that was when the building itself was demolished.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Adam said that today it's a fenced in lawn and parking area that belongs to a nursing home that was built where the garage once stood. There are also five trees planted on the same site. And the large tree that's in the middle of the yard is the marker that indicates where the brick wall once stood that the men were standing in front of when they were killed.
That's interesting.
Some people have reported that they see figures of gang members inside the nursing home. And I found one article that this guy claimed to have spoken to a couple of the nursing home residents who told them some pretty outlandish stories. But if you've ever had a conversation with somebody who lives in a nursing home, there's a really good chance that you're just hearing just whatever. Okay.
Right.
So they took that with a grain of salt and didn't really believe it, but there have been stories that the apparitions of these gangsters have appeared, you know, down the hallways of this nursing home.
Well, and by this time, those apparitions would probably need to be in a nursing home.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
It's been many years. So.
Right. I mean, you know, nursing home, funeral home at this point. But some people will say that if you walk by the fence of the nursing home, you may even get this weird sense of fear, you know, that, you know, just that kind of, we've all felt it. You have to go down in your basement at night and it's dark and you're kind of like, I shouldn't be afraid. I know exactly what's down here. And, you know, but yet you still get this weird sense of fear. And that's kind of what they're saying. People have experienced here. Screaming and gunfire have also been reported being heard even when there's no one around, when the site is
empty.
Now, there's a gentleman that is a Chicago ghost tour operator. His name is Tony Sibelski. And Tony says that when the garage came down, the bricks from the building became collector's items.
Yeah.
And this was especially the case if they had blood on them.
Oh, geez.
And really, if it had a bullet hole in there.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, they were spraying them with a Tommy gun, so there were probably quite a few bullet holes.
Probably. I mean, I got a picture of one in.
Yeah.
And that'll be in our thumbnail that is definitely a brick with a bullet hole in it.
Yeah, exactly. But a lot of stories started coming out that people were experiencing weird things after they got the bricks. Some people reported that they were being haunted, and some were getting in terrible accidents or even dying from horrific diseases.
Oh, wow.
So people began to believe that the bricks were cursed. Now, Tony goes on to explain that a Vancouver businessman named George Patey eventually bought the bricks with the intention of rebuilding the wall. Which he did. He had them shipped to Canada and they were packaged like fine china. Yeah. And apparently they were like labeled and numbered so that you could put the wall back exactly how it was.
Oh, that's interesting.
Now, his original plan was to display the wall as a traveling crime exhibit, showing in shopping malls and museums and galleries and such. However, it was 1968. So his timing was a little off because Robert Kennedy had just been assassinated and no one was very interested in seeing physical history of a murder.
Yeah. Yeah.
So in 1971, Patey found a new use for the bricks. They were reassembled in the men's room of his gangster-themed restaurant and nightclub in Gastown, which is a neighborhood in Vancouver. And he named the club the Banjo Palace. And he actually put plexiglass over the bricks so that gentlemen could aim at the bullet holes while relieving themselves.
Oh, good grief.
So they could pee in the bullet holes, or at least at them.
You know, that you're trying to, like, have a thing to recognize that seems disrespectful.
It does.
Doesn't it?
Yeah.
I'm going to pee on this.
Yeah.
This was the place you died. Guess what? I'm going to pee on it.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try to make it in this bullet hole.
Right.
That seems disrespectful.
I know it. And as the story went, if you hit one of the targets, the urinal would flush. Which I'm like, how would they have pulled that off in the 1970s? But that would have been.
I don't think they could have. Yeah.
So Cebulski also notes that the Banjo Palace eventually went bankrupt, possibly because of the bricks.
And possibly because you were peeing on
cursed bricks getting peed on,
mm-hmm.
you know, caused a lot of bad luck, and it caused the Banjo Palace to go bankrupt, or possibly.
Possibly. I could see that.
Yeah. So Patey put the 400 plus bricks into storage. Now, he would later offer them for sale with a written account of the massacre at a price of $1,000 each.
Good grief.
Yeah. Now, unfortunately for Patey, the bricks were being returned as fast as they were being sold. So,
yeah.
It was believed that anyone who purchased one of the bricks met with bad luck.
That could just be because you're such a so bad with money that you'd spend $1,000 on a brick.
Yeah. 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 That you would take $1,000 and go, I would like one of these bricks with a bullet hole and blood on it, please.
Yeah, one brick, please.
You want something haunted in your house? This is how you get it.
Yeah, exactly.
But they all would report things like weird illnesses, financial disaster, divorce, and even death.
Hey, you got divorced because your wife goes, what did you spend $1,000 on?
That's right.
No. Uh-uh.
Yeah. Can you imagine you or I coming home and trying to tell Ashley or Amanda, hey, guess what I bought?
No. That's something, even if I was stupid enough to do, I wouldn't let come out of my mouth.
Right.
Where did this $1,000? I don't know.
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 It fell off
maybe
truck.
It was stolen. I don't know.
But according to the buyers, the bricks were a powerful source of negative energy emanating from the St. Valentine's Day Massacre or its ghosts.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of weird.
Yeah, that's wild.
Yeah. David Jendricki posted this comment on an article about the site being haunted in February of 2024. Okay, so I'm going to read this quote. I found this. This was just, offhand. I don't usually scroll down and read comments that are left on articles.
Yeah.
But this one caught my eye.
And it was a year ago.
Yeah, just a year ago. The former massacre site at 2122 North Clark Street in Chicago is most definitely haunted. My daughter and son-in-law run a paranormal group out of Peoria, Illinois. Several years ago, we made the trek to the site of the massacre, which is now basically a parking lot. Armed with all the bells and whistles of paranormal investigating, the spirit box revealed many male voices trying to talk over each other. When my daughter asked how many of you are here, the answer sent a chill up everyone's spine. Loudly, clearly, and spoken by one male voice, the answer came up 7, which was the number of gangsters killed at the site.
Yep.
The next question asked, why are you here? And the same male voice responded, killed. He said it was an eerie and surreal afternoon. I bet.
That's interesting.
So if this is true, and I looked, there's a number of paranormal investigating groups in and around Illinois. Mm-hmm. Even Peoria has got more than one. Yeah. So I'm not sure. He doesn't say which one it is. So I'm not sure. But if this story is true, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's some good evidence. And I would imagine evidence.
Freaked him out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, especially the, you know, people say, well, sometimes these spirit boxes, you just get random words.
Yeah.
If it's a direct answer,
uh-huh,
and it's a correct direct answer, like seven,
yeah,
and killed,
yeah,
that's some evidence toward, hey, this is probably legit.
You know, I've always, yeah, because when I've watched these spirit box episodes on television or seen videos of them, you know, you hear that,
mm-hmm,
that white noise, that static of the, you know, like the radio, you're turning the dial back and forth, and you hear random things, and you don't hear them necessarily immediately in response to a question. And, you know, sometimes the answers are, well, maybe you could interpret it as meaning that. But to get this, to specifically, yep, hear this kind of answer, that's not all that common with spirit box stuff anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but, you know, to hear a clear answer twice, you know, in direct response to a question, that's pretty compelling. I mean, the odds that you would just randomly get anything that sounded like seven,
mm-hmm,
right at that time, I mean, it's astronomical.
Yeah, and to be the same voice twice.
Yeah, yeah, because you get a lot of different voices, different, you know, tones and inflex. I mean, everything.
Yep.
That it makes it really hard to tell. Is this a voice or is this just, did I catch something at the right moment? You know,
right,
that's coming through on a radio broadcast.
Right.
Now, the majority of the bricks were moved and reassembled at the Mob Museum in Las Vegas. So if you want to see the wall, you can still see it. You just have to go to Vegas, which, I mean, there's not a better place for a Mob Museum than Las Vegas, really.
No, that apparently there is one in Hot Springs, Arkansas.
Which is not where I would have expected it to be.
No. Apparently, though, that's where a lot of these gangsters went to relax.
Oh.
Like they would go retire, you know, for a weekend at Hot Springs, Arkansas, and there wasn't the gang wars there, and they could kind of blend in.
Huh. But that's pretty neat.
Yeah. Apparently, that's why there's a Mob Museum there. But it's nothing like the Las Vegas Mob Museum. It's like some dude's private collection in a converted house. You know,
yeah,
it's Arkansas.
It's like, yeah, it's like,
sorry, Arkansas.
It's probably cool as hell because it's probably got like a gangster signature in, mm-hmm, like a guest book or something. You know, yeah, I bet, yeah, there's some crazy stuff there. But in the Las Vegas Museum, there are stories that the sounds of gunfire and men moaning and falling to the ground have been heard around the area where the wall is displayed, much like what you hear at the original side of the garage.
Yeah.
But a lot of people believe that this may be a marketing ploy, just, you know, something to put out there to get people to come to the museum, which, I mean, who knows? I did not find a whole bunch of stories about,
mm-hmm,
you know, the haunted stuff going on at this museum in particular. So it might be that, but it does kind of put a neat little cap on the story of these haunted or cursed bricks.
Yeah. I think, you know, in my opinion, I would think the site would be the haunted thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, if you want to say the bricks are cursed or whatever, I can get on board with that to a degree. Mm-hmm. But to say that the gangster museum in Vegas is now haunted because of these bricks, mm-hmm. that it brought the ghost there, even though you're getting the same thing at the site, mm-hmm. like, I don't think it would happen. You know, just my opinion.
Yeah.
I don't think these same events would happen in two separate places. I think it would be tied to either the bricks or the location.
Right. Yeah. One or the other. Both. It doesn't seem like it would be both.
Right.
Now, the little alley park at 2122 North Clark is also said to be haunted. People say that their dogs get freaked out walking by it. Phantom sounds are heard, screams, moans, gunshots, as we mentioned earlier. Photographs taken there have shown orbs and strange mists appearing. But the owner of the building next door says that they have poltergeist activity that takes place inside.
Really?
Yeah, nothing specific, just a lot of, you know, noises and stuff being moved and knocked over and things like that. But to wrap this up, this is a weird end to this. There are stories, and you can find a lot on these stories, that Bugs Moran's brother-in-law haunted Al Capone immediately after the killings. Now, Bugs Moran's brother-in-law was already dead, and the spirit came around and just started tormenting him.
Hmm.
Now, it is said that Capone had tried to send this entity to the other side, to get it to cross over by using a medium in 1931, but it didn't work.
Hmm.
Now, the entity's name is said to be James Clark, who was one of the men that was killed in the shooting. But even after Capone was released from prison, he still complained that he was haunted by this entity all the way up until the day he died.
Oh, wow.
Which, again, that it seems bizarre that that would happen. You know, like we said, Capone wasn't even in the area, even if he had ordered the hit. So why would this spirit go and track him down specifically?
Rather than those who pulled the trigger.
Yeah, the people that actually did the killing.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, you can find a lot of information about Capone talking about this.
Yeah.
But one thing you have to remember is that by the time he went to prison, he was riddled with syphilis.
Oh, yeah.
Which turns your brain into Swiss cheese.
Sure, yep.
So there's a really good chance that Capone's own thoughts of having ordered this hit haunted him to the point that he believed that one of the victims was appearing to him and tormenting him as a means of revenge after life.
That's true. That's true. It could have all been in his head.
You know, I would kind of doubt that somebody like Capone would have felt any guilt or remorse.
Right. Right.
But maybe, you know, maybe towards the end of his life, you know, especially if he was dealing with the cognitive decline that syphilis brings, you know, maybe at some point he did. I don't know. But, you know, whether or not you want to believe he was haunted, whether or not you want to believe it was just in his head, there are a lot of stories, you know, that he had talked about this. So
that's interesting.
Yeah. You know, pretty neat. We thought was very apropos for Valentine's Day, you know, so mm-hmm. you know, sit back and snuggle up with your significant other and listen to how seven gangsters met their demise.
Right. Listen to a mass murder.
A little true crime mixed with ghost story for you here on Valentine's Day. And
and let us know if you appreciated that.
Yeah.
The true crime mixed with ghost stories, because we might be able to pull this off with other other events.
Absolutely.
If y'all like it.
Absolutely. Hey, and the best place to let us know that is in our Facebook group. It's called The Graveyard. Go on Facebook, search us up. We've got thousands of members in there. It's really a great place to get some cool stories and to hear some unique personal experiences. It's a safe place. You know, nobody's going to call you a nut job or any of that stuff. Go on and check out our website, which is graveyardpodcast.com. That is where you can purchase Graveyard Tales merchandise. You can listen to the show, and you can find the links to become a patron. And as we, at the beginning of the show, we thanked everyone who has ever donated to the show. You are the reason that we're recording our 300th episode tonight. So until next time, we'll save you a seat in the graveyard.
See you soon.